Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Phil Dierking. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Thousands of teachers in two U.S. states are striking to demand higher pay and increased education funding. More than 30,000 educators in Oklahoma began a walkout Monday and have promised to stay on strike until their demands are met. Oklahoma's largest teachers' union has called for a $10,000 pay raise for educators over the next 3 years. It is also seeking an increase of $75 million in state education funding. Union officials said the strike led to classes being canceled for about 500,000 of Oklahoma's 700,000 public school students. Thousands of striking teachers traveled to the state capital, Oklahoma City, to join a mass demonstration. The president of the Oklahoma Education Association, Alicia Priest, called on all teachers to join the protest to pressure lawmakers to act. Priest says teachers and students have dealt with 11 years of funding cuts that have prevented upgrades of school equipment. Class sizes have also been growing. "We will not continue to be ignored," Priest said in a message posted on Facebook. "Educators will continue to walk until we get a deal that our students deserve," she said. Oklahoma came in at 47th place among U.S. states in money spent per student in 2016, the National Education Association estimated. The association also reported the state came in near the bottom in pay, with the average teacher in Oklahoma earning about $45,000 a year. Oklahoma's legislature is controlled by Republicans, and lawmakers had sought to avoid tax increases in recent years. The state's governor, Mary Fallon, is also a Republican. Fallon signed legislation last week to give teachers a raise of 15% to 18%. But many educators said the amount was not good enough and decided to walk out. Ray Lovelace is a single mother and third grade teacher in Northwest Oklahoma. "If I didn't have a second job, I'd be on food stamps," she told the Associated Press. Lovelace is among many teachers who have taken a second job to earn extra money. She says she works an extra 30 to 40 hours a week teaching internet courses for another school. Schools across Kentucky were also empty. Some were closed for spring break vacation, while other schools canceled classes to allow teachers to join protests in the state capital, Frankfort. Thousands of teachers showed up to demonstrate. Last Friday, hundreds of teachers in Kentucky called in sick to protest last-minute changes to their retirement system. Republican lawmakers in Kentucky passed the pension bill Thursday. The measure continued pension benefits for most state workers, but reduced them for new teachers. Lawmakers said the move was necessary to make up for underfunding of the state's teacher retirement system. Teacher unions condemned passage of the bill and promised large protests to oppose it. Language arts teacher Leslie Buckner said the goal of the protests was to send a clear message to Kentucky lawmakers. If we continue to stay united, they cannot turn away from us. They cannot turn their backs on us. The latest demonstrations followed protests and strikes in West Virginia in February. Teachers statewide walked off their jobs for more than a week. The educators eventually won their demand for a 5% increase in pay. In Arizona, teachers held protests last week demanding more education funding. Teachers there are also demanding a 20% pay increase and are considering a strike to press their demands. Many Arizona teachers wore red clothes to school on Monday to express support for teachers in Oklahoma and Kentucky. I'm Brian Lynn.
This is what's trending today. California officials are praising workers for rescuing a 13-year-old boy who fell into a river of sewage in Los Angeles. The boy, Jesse Hernandez, spent more than 12 hours in the city's large underground sewage system. It is filled with refuse liquids and other waste materials, some of them poisonous. Jesse had been playing at a public park with other children during a family gathering on Sunday. At one point, the children were on pieces of wood that covered an opening leading to the sewer system. One of the wooden planks broke. The boy fell about 8 meters down and landed in fast-moving sewage, said Brian Humphrey, a spokesman for the Los Angeles Fire Department. The other children quickly told adults what had happened. The adults then called an emergency telephone line for help. Rescuers immediately began searching for Jesse underground. They set cameras on flotation devices, which they put into the sewage system. Rescuers finally found Jesse after seeing images of handprints on a pipe. A crew of sanitation workers hurried to the area and opened a manhole. The first thing they heard was "help," said Adele Hage-Khalil, an official with the Los Angeles Sanitation Department. The crew lowered down a long hose to Jesse, who was about 3 meters deep in the pipe. The boy held onto the line while workers pulled him up. By the time workers found Jesse, about 700 meters of pipe had been inspected during a 12-hour period. Jesse was found less than 2 kilometers from where he fell in. He was taken to a hospital for a full physical examination and to be reunited with his family. In addition to the major rescue effort, Humphrey credited the boy for being able to survive. Not only did he survive being pushed through sewage, moving at speeds of 24 kilometers an hour, Jesse was able to find a small area of breathable air and wait there until he was found. And that's what's trending today.
American Chris Spear has been cooking food for others since he was 16 years old. Spear has worked for a chef at large restaurants and even had almost 100 employees reporting to him. But there came a time when he grew tired of this job and wanted to be more creative. So he stopped working for restaurants and set up his own food catering business. It is called Perfect Little Bites. Spear told VOA that spending many hours preparing food doesn't make him feel tired. But he was concerned that becoming an independent chef and not working in a restaurant would make him feel lonely. That led him to create an online networking group called Chefs Without Restaurants. It is a place for chefs to exchange ideas, advice, and even customer referrals. Spears says that while the service is new, the idea for it is not. I've been thinking about the Chefs Without Restaurants for about 5 years now, even before I took Perfect Little Bites full-time. Because I kept thinking about, well, when I do this full-time, who are going to be my colleagues? Who are going to be the people who I can bounce ideas off? How am I going to be able to do things like cater an event that's maybe outside my range of 30 people? Like, do I have a resource where I can pull in one or two other people? Spears said he didn't feel like having full-time employees for his catering business, but he did want a way to communicate with others in the food preparation business. The online group started last January. Since then, around 100 chefs have joined it. Spear said that independent chefs have many different kinds of businesses, but don't always get recognized. He wanted to use the group to bring attention to chefs who normally would not get it. I wanted to have something that's beneficial, but also didn't cost money. We are a Facebook group where I can just post and say, "Hey, next Wednesday, a customer wants to do dinner here," and the price range, where they live. If anyone is maybe interested, send me a personal message and I get you their information. Spears thinks this network can help those not working in the food service industry. He and other chefs are building a website that lists the group's members, what their specialties are, which ones are able to cater large parties, and personal chefs for smaller events. Lana and Bobby Browner are a wife and husband team who own their catering business, Bent and Bent Events, in Frederick, Maryland. The Browners specialize in Creole and Caribbean cooking. They also prepare and mix together foods that are available locally in Frederick County, Maryland. When the Browners heard about Chefs Without Restaurants, they decided to become members. The biggest difficulty for many chefs, they said, is that they don't often form partnerships because they are competing for business. But you don't have that in this group, Lana Browner noted. What we experienced so far is a lot of learning about different chefs in the area. It's even been interesting to get comments from chefs that work outside Frederick, she added. Chefs Without Restaurants is also bringing more businesses to local eateries. One example is Maryland Bakes, a place where members often meet and prepare food in a common area. Terry Rowe, owner of Maryland Bakes, says the group brings more energy to local small food businesses. They bring connections, she said. They bring creative ideas and just the whole network of independent people joining together. The group is popular with the local food community. Olive Oil and Vinegar is one of the local stores Spear likes to visit. It often holds events to present cooking ideas and let chefs meet their customers. Store owner Sharon Streb says small businesses should help one another succeed. I think by sharing that and having them come to the store, Streb explains, they get in front of our customers and hopefully we get in front of their customers. That's a win-win for both of us. She adds that it's difficult for small businesses and many don't succeed. So it's important they work together. I'm Phil Dierking.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the spring of 1865, the American Civil War was over, and the president who had led the Union during that war was dead. Abraham Lincoln had been murdered before the final surrender of Confederate forces. Now, the reunited nation had a new president, Andrew Johnson. He had been Lincoln's vice president. The Chief Justice of the United States swore Johnson into office a few hours after Lincoln's death. Most of Lincoln's cabinet was there, together with leading members of Congress. They looked to the new president with a mixture of shock and hope. Shep O'Neill and Tony Riggs begin the story of America's 17th president.
Andrew Johnson was, like Abraham Lincoln, a man of the people. He was born in North Carolina. His family was poor. There was no money or time for young Andrew to go to school. When he was 14 years old, his mother sent him to work for a tailor to learn to make clothes. Andrew worked hard. He opened his own tailoring business in the eastern part of the state of Tennessee. When he was 18, he married. His wife, Eliza, taught him to read and write.
Andrew became active in politics. At the age of 21, he was elected to the town council. 2 years later, he became mayor of the town. At 35, he won a seat in Congress in Washington. Next, he became governor of Tennessee. Then the state made him one of its two senators. The poor tailor boy was a success.
Andrew Johnson was a member of the Democratic Party. In the presidential election of 1860, he supported his party's candidate, not the candidate of the Republican Party, Abraham Lincoln. But Lincoln won the election, and as a result, Southern states carried out their earlier threat. They began leaving the Union to form their own nation. Johnson opposed this secession. He believed the South should remain part of the United States. He decided he had no choice but to support the Republican president. Most of the other citizens in Tennessee disagreed with him. They decided to leave the Union. Andrew Johnson had to flee his home to save his life. He returned only after Union forces took control of Tennessee and made him military governor.
President Lincoln noticed the man from Tennessee who supported the Union over the opposition of others. In 1864, Lincoln decided to run for re-election. He chose Johnson to be his vice presidential candidate. Lincoln hoped Johnson would win the support of Union-loving Democrats. He hoped Johnson would help heal the wounds between North and South. Now, Lincoln was dead, and Johnson was president. It was up to this little-known former tailor to make the decisions on Reconstruction, on rebuilding the Union. Johnson, not Lincoln, would decide if Reconstruction would be easy or hard. Johnson would choose if the North would punish the defeated rebel states or be merciful to them.
The radicals of Lincoln's Republican Party wanted severe Reconstruction. They said the South was a defeated enemy. They demanded strong punishment for all Southerners who took part in the rebellion. These radicals had disliked Lincoln's plans for Reconstruction. They felt he was too weak. Now, they hoped Johnson would share their ideas. They urged him to call a special session of Congress to pass strong legislation against the South. The radicals had reason to believe the new president agreed with them. He had called the rebels traitors. He had demanded strong action against them when the war ended. "The time has come," Johnson had said, "when the American people should understand what crime is, and that it should be punished."
But Andrew Johnson surprised the radicals. He did not call the special session of Congress. Instead, he announced his own program for the Southern states. Johnson declared a pardon for all former Confederates who promised to support the Union and obey laws against slavery. Then he permitted former officials of the Confederacy to run for office in their state's new elections. Many of these former rebels were elected. The radical Republicans were angry. They saw these elections as proof that the South had not really changed. They accused Johnson of being too soft. They urged him to punish the rebels. One radical newspaper wrote, "There is only one sure and safe policy for the immediate future. The North must remain the dictator of the Republic until the spirit of the North shall become the spirit of the whole country. The South's treason is still unpunished. Southerners cannot be trusted."
The radicals also worried about what would happen to the recently freed slaves. They said the new state governments of the South would not treat blacks as free and equal citizens. As proof, they pointed to new laws the Southern legislatures passed. For example, the state legislature in Mississippi said no black person could rent farmland. It said a black person needed special permission to work at any job except farming. Mississippi also passed a law saying a black person could be forced to work for a white man, usually his former owner, if he had no other job. Another way the state governments in the South acted against blacks was by refusing to give them the right to vote.
The radical Republicans decided that President Johnson's Reconstruction program must be stopped. They began working to get control of Congress, to pass their own program. Only by gaining political power could they punish the South and guarantee full political rights to former slaves. The radicals tried to take control in two ways. First, they refused to let many of the recently elected Southern congressmen take their seats when Congress opened. Then they formed their own Joint Committee on Reconstruction. This committee, not the Senate or the House of Representatives, would make many of the decisions about Reconstruction.
Radical lawmakers took other steps to seize control of Reconstruction efforts in the South. Congress had established a government agency to take care of black refugees in the South. The agency gave food and clothing to former slaves who had no food, money, or jobs. It began to teach them to read and write. Republicans in Congress moved to extend the life of the agency and increase its powers. They passed a bill and sent it to the White House for the president's approval. President Johnson vetoed the bill. He said it would create false hopes among former slaves. He also said it was unconstitutional. The radicals tried to overturn Johnson's veto. However, they failed to get the necessary votes.
Congress passed several other bills giving the federal government power to protect the rights of blacks in the southern states. President Johnson vetoed these bills, too. He said they interfered with the rights of the states. These defeats made the radicals even more angry. Their newspapers began a steady attack against the president and his policy toward the South. Some even accused him of treason.
Many Americans agreed with this criticism of President Johnson. They gave the radicals a big victory in congressional elections of 1866. Radical leaders gained the power to pass any bill they wished, even over the president's veto. And they wasted no time doing just that. Time after time, they voted to overturn Andrew Johnson's vetoes. The atmosphere in Washington became very tense. Relations between Congress and the White House sank to their lowest level in history. The political skies darkened. Soon, the storm broke. The radicals tried something that had never been tried before. They tried to remove the president from office. The conflict between the radicals and Andrew Johnson would provide some of the most historic and intense moments in American history. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.